Ethiopians in violation of Geneva Protocols of 1925, which banned its use, killed 250,000 Ethiopians within 3 years of the war, and by some estimates, one-third died from chemical weapons. And this may sound familiar, they bombed Red Cross hospitals and ambulances. They massacred prisoners. Italy's occupation of Ethiopia lasted until 1943, and Italy did not formally recognize Ethiopia's sovereignty until 1947. But the biggest issue to me is that the Western countries were very quick to recognize Italy's occupation of Ethiopia as legitimate, and war crimes were ignored until 1940, when other Western powers entered, the war against Italy. They still didn't really address war crimes. Soviets initially said nothing before the League of Nations, in part because they were selling coal and oil to Italy. So technically, and this is an argument that I make all the time, I've been making it for 30 years, World War II begins on African soil.
You're listening to Robin D.G. Kelly, Solidarity and Black Resistance to Fascism and Genocide. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website alternativeradio.org.
World War II begins on African soil. It begins in Ethiopia. That is the beginning. That is the front. From there, Italian troops attack British colonies in Somalia, in Egypt, Sudan, Kenya, like around 1940. Okay, so African Americans immediately mobilized in defense of Ethiopia, raising money for relief and medical aid, black communists in Harlem, especially with the help of some Garveyites, created the Provisional Committee for the Defense of Ethiopia. Black men from across the nation volunteered to fight. The Pan-African Reconstruction Association recruited 1,000 volunteers in New York, 1,500 in Philadelphia, 8,000 in Chicago, 5,000 in Detroit, 2,000 in Kansas City. The Garveyite Black Legion established a training camp in upstate New York for some 3,000 volunteers, and they were ready to fight. They were ready to go to Ethiopia to fight, right, to defend Haile Selassie. And that's another complicated thing. But Selassie was pressured by the U.S. to refuse these volunteers, and only two African-American combatants ever reached Ethiopia, and both were pilots. So the first location in Europe, though, where the war began was Spain. So in 1936, when Franco led a military campaign to overthrow the Republican government in Spain, the Loyalists, right, consisting of a popular front government of socialists, communists, anarchists, and liberals, they were attacked by Franco, and Franco's armies were supported by what? German planes and Italian planes. Germany and Italy provided arms, supplies, and aerial attack squads. The so-called Western democracies claimed neutrality, even as American corporations like Texas Oil Company, extended credit to Franco's forces. Only the Soviet Union and Mexico came to the aid of the Loyalists. And it's interesting when you think about it because, we I'm trying to think about where we are now and what does it mean to back a violent genocidal war, right, with resources, and no one comes to the aid of those who are being killed except for those who volunteer. So the Loyalists appeal to volunteers who came from all over the world. And you may know the story. 3,000 people from the United States came to fight or participate in the war in Spain. 90 were African-American, and one black woman, Celera Key, served as a nurse. Crawford Morgan, originally from North Carolina, spoke for nearly all black volunteers when he linked the events in Ethiopia with fascist tendencies. In the U.S., mainly, he argued, Negroes have been getting lynched in this country by mobs. So he says, this is what fascist tendencies look like. Vaughn Love, another volunteer, had collected medical supplies for Hands Off Ethiopia, and then he fought in Spain, defined fascism as, quote, the enemy of all black aspirations. So what I'm saying here is that We date the beginning of World War II in Europe to 1939, when it really begins in 1935 in Africa. When fascists invade Ethiopia, Western capitalist nations didn't care because it was Africa. When fascists backed the civil war in Spain to overthrow an elected government, the Western capitalist nations didn't care because they're communists and socialists. All the while, fascists are doing business with U.S. companies, and their forces are getting stronger. In other words, they're strengthening, U.S. capital strengthening fascism in Germany and Italy this whole period. And then they're going to turn around and fight them. Now, if we turn to like Crawford Morgan and Von Loves and Langston Hughes about fascism in the South, it's an interesting kind of story. Now, a lot of people are familiar with the fact that Nazis drew directly on American eugenicist ideas about the purity of blood and Aryan superiority. They know that the Nuremberg laws, for example, were modeled after U.S. Jim Crow laws. And we know that, and that's interesting. But see, to me, that part's not surprising. Of course, the U.S. is the basis, the roots of so much racism. I know, I live here, you know. But to me, the main story is something else. First, that these models were not just building blocks for German fascism, but they were evidence of existing fascism in the U.S. South. Violence was the primary mode of governance, and much of the violence was outsourced, which is the roots of slave patrols, you know? And before that, I just learned. The system of law enforcement, and when I say law enforcement, let's read it as property protection, depended on deputizing every white man. The state didn't have to take responsibility for the violent subjugation of its black population when you have a few million Daniel Pennies and Kyle Rittenhouses ready to do it. The South was a one-party dictatorship under which white property ruled. And that white property rule in the South extended to the nation. Let me explain. So by denying black people the vote, Southern congressmen enjoyed a concentration of power. They chaired 29 of the 47 committees in the House, 13 of 33 committees in the Senate, and these were all the most powerful committees: judiciary, agriculture, appropriations, banking and currency, commerce, finance, military affairs, ways and means. And besides counting black people who could not vote for congressional representation, poll taxes made it impossible for even some poor whites to vote. So voter turnout in southern states was like 20% or lower, right, of eligible voters. And not because people didn't want to go vote, right? And so they end up getting the most powerful legislators in Congress and Senate, who then have seniority because they keep being voted in. A white property dictatorship in the South explains why there was no federal anti-lynching bill passed under Roosevelt. In fact, do you know when the federal anti-lynching bill was passed? Thank you, 2022. They also insisted on local control of all New Deal agencies to ensure unequal wages, payments, and maintain segregation. So this is the Faustian bargain that Roosevelt made. Complete suppression of democracy in the South in exchange for support for the New Deal. So don't keep saying that the New Deal is the greatest thing that's ever happened and we need to go back to that. You know, I understand the loss of the welfare state, but we have to be serious about the history and how that happened and who lost. But the key point here is that fascism persisted in the U.S., it persisted in South Africa, it persisted in many colonies after Second World War The Second World War did not end fascism. In fact, it expanded. Claudia Jones, in a brilliant essay published in 1946, suggests that the danger of fascism is not over in 1946, but alive and well in the South. And she writes, "Today, the main danger of fascism to the world comes from the most colossal imperialist forces which are concentrated within the United States. The perpetrators of these attacks are the representatives of the most reactionary section of monopoly capital and of the semi-feudal economy of the Black Belt." And she goes on to talk about what I don't have time to talk about, is this a wave of lynchings. and killings of black veterans in particular, right up from 1945, 46, 47, throughout. And we know what happens after that in terms of black people trying to get the right to vote. It's just nothing but chaos and violence. So that's why in 1951, Paul Robeson and William L. Patterson, who's the executive of the Civil Rights Congress, submitted a 225-page petition to the United Nations Assembly, General Assembly, titled "We Charge Genocide: The Crime of Government Against the Negro." And Patterson and his team use what was then new, the UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, which was adopted by the UN General Assembly December 19, 1948. And they used that, the Convention on Genocide, to make the case that black people were victims of genocide. Now, it documented racial violence after the war, at least 153 killings of black people, and presented a legal argument that identified systematic violence and terrorism as part of state policy to crush movements of opposition and maintain the racial and class status quo. Now, Raphael Lemkin, who coined the term genocide, he had a fit. He insisted, first, it didn't apply to Negroes. He accused the authors of sabotaging the U.S. Senate's ratification of the convention and, quote, diverting attention away from the crimes of genocide perpetrated in the Soviet Union. Now, in fairness to Lemkin, he changes his mind, by the way. And most people don't like that. They like to attack him. But he actually thought about it, and he said, you know what? Black people do fall under the category of genocide. And then he actually worked on Algeria as well. So in fairness to Lemkin, he actually came around. But my point is, anti-communism, his own anti-communism, made it hard for him to actually see the argument that they're making. But it's not as if black people didn't know this. That is to say, this is an article, October 21st, 1950, from the Amsterdam News, headline, UN Law May Be Hard on Dixie, which argued that, quote, the lynching of Negroes in the United States and race destruction in the Union of South Africa would be considered crimes of genocide. So they didn't need recharge genocide to know that. All the black people understood that, certainly the journalists. U.S. senators understood this as well. They understood it all too well, which explains why the U.S. did not ratify the Genocide Convention until 1988. So like previous petitions, Patterson draws a direct line between domestic genocide and colonial war. Of course, the story of black anti-fascism and resistance to genocide doesn't end here. From 64 to 72, the U.S. had more urban insurrections than any other Western country in the world. In other words, war was taking place. It's not a stretch to say the United States was the epicenter of urban warfare in the Western Hemisphere, and it was also the epicenter of counterinsurgency tactics in the hemisphere. Police and the National Guard turned black neighborhoods into war zones, arresting tens of thousands of people, employing tanks, machine guns, and tear gas to pacify the community. I don't know why anyone doesn't realize that war was taking place in the United States on U.S. soil. But it just was in the ghettos. Like, that's war. So, therefore, some of these people involved in rebellions sparked by these incidents of state violence named the repression fascist, and they saw themselves as anti-fascist, and hence some of the use of fascism here. So consider Revolutionary Action Movement, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, the Community Alert Patrol, Black Liberation Army, the Brown Berets, the National Committee to Combat Fascism, the Black Liberation Front, all of them use the term fascism to refer to state violence and to the way the state treated black people. State and vigilante violence, of course, actually escalates in the 70s and 80s with the defeat of the insurgency of 1968. I just want to say the black radical tradition against fascism and genocide continues to this day, and so does the deep commitment to internationalism, be it Haiti, Congo, Sudan, and of course, Palestine. I want to end by returning to the present and to say a few words about the weaponization of anti-Semitism, something that our university administrators all over the country has chosen to endorse. In spite of the fact that the current administration in the White House attacks any criticism of Israel as cover to shield its own anti-Semitism. That's what they do. So we witness a dress rehearsal of Trump's policies when the House Committee on Education Workforce, led by Virginia Fox and Elise Stefanik, held McCarthy-like hearings charging, quote-unquote, liberal university presidents with allowing their institutions to become hotbeds of anti-Semitism. Now, if anti-Semitism was the primary concern, they would have investigated the white nationalists and Nazis who attacked our students on my campus at UCLA for their Palestine solidarity encampment, right? But none of them were investigated. If anti-Semitism was a concern, the January 6th insurrectionists, right, would be investigated. I mean, you had people wearing sweatshirts that said Camp Auschwitz. You had people wearing T-shirts that said 6 MWE, 6 million weren't enough. And they all got exonerated, right? Christian Zionists and white Christian nationalists make up a significant part of the MAGA base. They claim to be defenders of Israel, and the Israeli right embraces figures like Reverend John Hagee, head of Christians United for Israel. And this is the same minister who once preached that God sent Hitler to hunt the Jews, and the Jews will suffer for eternity in hell. I'm so stupid. I think that's anti-Semitic, but what the hell? Now, these are the folks who preach the new dispensation that Jesus will rise from the dead, return the Holy Land to the Christians. So whereas Israeli leadership is chomping at the bit to take all of Palestine, you know, Eretz Israel, Christian Zionists are waiting for Judgment Day so that they could take all of Israel from the Jews. In this scenario, financing Israeli aggression and shielding it from international law does not make Jews safer, especially those Jews who are anti-Zionists or just critical of Israeli policies. And the Trump administration will continue to stay silent on right-wing anti-Semitism while punishing all supporters of Palestinian liberation. In other words, and follow me here, the current regime demands fealty to Israel, but not to the Jewish community. Jews are still suspect, and Christianity is perceived to be under threat. And if you don't believe me, read Executive Order 14202, Eradicating Anti-Christian Bias. Just read it. Think about what it means, right, for Zionist organizations like B'Tahr to turn in foreign national students critical of Israel for deportation. Here, I can't help but think about all those Israeli men who show up at our protests, who heckle and disrupt our protests, and they're wrapped in American flags. Sometimes it's like the flag of Israel and the United States, but mostly American flags. And they're standing there calling for more deportations when the same government they're working for just pardoned proponents of the Great Replacement Theory. Think about that. They delude themselves into thinking they're safe, right? And of course, none of this is new. And by the way, they're coming for all of us. And I will say publicly right here, I'm being filmed, if they come after anybody, including Zionist Jews, you don't think I'm gonna defend them? Of course I am. Because this is about a war against people that's deeply anti-Semitic, and they don't even realize it. It's like they're cutting their own throat. So, of course, none of this is new. Those of us who have been fighting for Palestine's freedom are familiar with Canary Mission. They got a terrible picture of me on there. posting names of people, it falsely accuses of anti-Semitism, or the practice of doxing, which is illegal, or the ADL's long history of spying on progressive organizations or groups such as Israel on Campus Coalition with a $9 million budget to collect information on students and faculty engaged in Palestine justice work and feed that information directly to Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs. Now, rather than investigate these organizations for libel or invasion of privacy, or violating the Foreign Agents Registration Act, the state incorporates them into the police apparatus. It's like the deputizing of white men, the deputizing of those Zionist Jews who think somehow that the state that's against them is for them because they do the dirty work of defending a right-wing regime in Israel, in defending the occupation, defending war and genocide. So many of us are panicking over Colombia's appeasement. By the way, you know, when UCLA's appeasement appears, it's going to make Colombia look like the resistance. It's coming. But what they forget, though, is that at least since 2009, American colleges and universities have been relentless in their suppression of Palestine advocacy. They didn't need the Trump administration. Before the encampments, university administrators have been predisposed to arrest student protesters, initiate disciplinary hearings, and rarely have university presidents elected to negotiate seriously in a way that would consider divesting from companies that fuel and finance war and occupation of Palestine. No college or university has suffered financially from divesting from apartheid South Africa, from private prisons, or the fossil fuel companies. Show me one university that went out of business because they divested. Just show me one. You can't, because I'm right. So, you know, histories of anti-apartheid, ironically, right, the anti-apartheid protests on campuses at Yale, Princeton, Cornell, UCLA, are used to advertise their commitment to social justice. I'm sure it happens here, too. The truth is, they are worried about the symbolic costs of bucking the Palestine exception and the real costs in terms of potential loss of donors. That's the thing they're concerned about. Calls for divestment or even a permanent ceasefire elicit absurd charges of being pro-Hamas. Seriously? Anti-Semitic. Proponents of Israel's annihilation. Trustees and donors have gone further, demanding even harsher punishments for student protesters and conspiring with the corporate and legal world to deny them future employment, which is also illegal. And university leaders have chosen to cower before such threats rather than stand up for the rights, well-being, and safety of all their tuition-paying students. And the last point is really crucial because it explains why our universities have become police states. UCLA spent $12 million in spring alone just to suppress protests. The UC system spent on a whole $29 million. My point is that, you know, it's important to name the ongoing attack on critical thought by way of the Palestine exception, waged by our own liberal administrations, because it is so easy to blame the right. The lessons here, for me at least, and this is a kind of broader lesson altogether, is that defeating the kind of fascism we face now requires something deeper than defeating the current administration or winning elections. But it requires a deeper ideological shift. And for me, it means to go to the root, to understand that when we keep repeating Martin Niemöller's words, "First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I'm not a socialist," and so forth and so on, you know, it's kind of disingenuous, because we have to find a way to live the implications of the warning, not just repeat them maybe once in a while when things get hard. That is to say, we need to always stand in solidarity and fight for others as if our lives depended on it, right? And that means thinking beyond nation and pledging allegiance, not to Israel, not to the United States, but to the world and all life, right? All living things. It means seeing every racist and sexist and homophobic and transphobic act, every brutal act of state violence, every deportation, every denial of health care for the most vulnerable and so forth, as an attack on all of us, as an attack on the class. It means standing up for the oppressed everywhere. And we don't have to ask for something in return, right? That's what solidarity means. And we have to remember, and again, this is the Black radical tradition, that some of the most dynamic movements emerge at the height of racist reaction, economic crisis, war, and militarism. These movements were fueled not by false optimism, but by a deep understanding of the reality that they face. The Black radical tradition understood that the only way to ensure our survival, right, our very survival, was to envision a radically different future for all of us, everyone in it, even the people we don't like, and fight to bring it into existence. Thank you.
You were just listening to Robin D.G. Kelly, Solidarity and Black Resistance to Fascism and Genocide. He spoke in April 2025 at UMass Amherst. Robin D.G. Kelly, a professor of history at UCLA, is a distinguished scholar, public intellectual, and award-winning author. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Heather Cox Richardson, Angela Davis, Gabor Mate, Tariq Ali, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Robin D.G. Kelly on Solidarity and Black Resistance to Fascism and Genocide, and for Howard Zinn's classic book, You Can't Be Neutral on a Moving Train, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Sat Jolly and the Media Education Foundation. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Thelonious Monk, Blue Monk.
Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The briny waters of Utah's Great Salt Lake fluctuate up and down from year to year. But in general, lake levels have been dropping over the past few decades. And in 2022, the lake hit its lowest level since measurements began in 1847.
This was the lowest that has been recorded going back during this fairly long record. So it was quite notable.
Paul Leukath of Portland State University and his colleagues investigated why the lake dropped so low. They found that most of the drop resulted from reduced stream flow into the lake. But warmer temperatures also caused more water to evaporate out of the lake. Siri Bagalki, a PhD student at Portland State, led the new study.
The record low in 2022 would not have been set without an increasing trend in evaporation.
As the climate warms, that trend is likely to continue. But stream flow can be affected by a range of factors, from precipitation to human activities. So predicting lake levels in a warming climate is hard. The Great Salt Lake hosts millions of migratory birds and even helps form lake effect snow over Utah ski resorts. So knowing how lake levels might change will be vital. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Hello, this is Min Chuong. I'm a volunteer here. Thank you for listening to CJSF. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Radio. Burnaby.